This is Poured Over, a show about stories presented by the booksellers of Barnes & Noble.
I'm Jenna Siri, a bookseller and associate producer of Poured Over, and today I am very excited to talk about one of my favorite things, math, with Sarah Hart, who is a mathematician, a professor, has a very cool job, and has written Once Upon a Prime, which goes through connections between literature and mathematics, from books from Moby Dick to Jurassic Park to so many things in between. And as I was reading, I was telling facts and things that I was reading to so many people with a wide range of response, but I can't wait for people to talk about this book. The hardcover came out in 2023, and it's going to be coming out in paperback soon. So, Sarah, I would love for you to talk with us about the book a little bit.
Great. Well, thank you so much for having me. Yeah. And, you know, I'm a mathematician, but I've always loved reading and books and literature from a very small child. So I, you know, for me, these things have always been part of my life, both of them. And so it's been a joy to be able to write about them together.
So as you were starting to compile this book and to sort of go through, there's so much incredible research and so many different books that some that I had never even heard of to go through. You have a great bibliography in the back, so no one should be worried about taking their notes through, though I have a lot of spooky scribbles, I'll say, in my copy as I was going through. But I would wonder to start out, how did you come to this idea and how were you sure that this was the book you wanted to write?
So for me, I've always read lots of books widely. I've just always been, have a book on the go. That's the person I am. I get anxious if I'm going somewhere and I haven't got a book with me because, you know, what am I going to do if I have 30 seconds? So lots of reading through my life. And I have always kind of noticed and spotted mathematical ideas that are there, whether that's the structure of the writing or mathematical symbolism. I've always seen these things. And so when the opportunity came to write about them, for me, the hardest bit, and as you say, there's a really big list of books at the end. I had this little section at the end with so many books, and some of them I didn't have time to talk about. The challenge was, how am I going to narrow it down? Because there's so many wonderful things you could talk about. So what I decided to do, and the way to structure this project, this endeavor, was I kind of thought of three ways or divided into three ways that mathematics and literature can have a conversation. And one is about the structure, like how books are put together, how poems are put together. And mathematics, you know, is the language of structure and pattern and symmetry and all those lovely things like that. So anything to do with a way that you're fitting something together, there'll be mathematical ideas. So we talk about poetry and things like this, and also novels that have structures. That's kind of the first part of it. And then the second way that mathematics and literature can talk with each other is around symbolism and imagery and metaphor and those ideas, where mathematics is just there, everything from the numbers you see in fairy tales and folk tales, all the way through to, you know, we can get as esoteric as you like and talk about calculus in Tolstoy, or you can talk about the number three and how it's everywhere in fairy tales. So that's like the second thing. And the third thing, because there are three things, because three is everywhere, is about actually mathematical ideas. And sometimes you get mathematician characters in books. And that, for me, is really interesting, how literature deals with ideas and deals with mathematicians as characters and mathematical ideas. And that happens, you know, in all sorts of different books and genres. So, yeah, kind of three different aspects of how this can happen. And then choosing examples in each one of those was how it came together, really.
I love the structure of it because it allows a really great reading experience if you just start at the beginning and go through. But kind of like some of the other intriguingly structured books you talk about, you can also sort of dip in and find the pieces that really interest you and read it out of order and add things in a different way. Yeah. And I found that really fun of being like, there's all this information here and you get to sort of play with it and find the things that really work for you.
I did not want this book, and it's not, let's start at the beginning and have a linear thing where, you know, we pile on and on. Actually, no, it's not like that at all. Every chapter has its own flavor, and then you can go in at whatever chapter you want, whatever grabs your interest first. And of course, then I hope you are led then into, oh, actually, I think I'll read this and maybe there's interesting ideas here. So I want to show people, you know, we can find just a little bit of mathematical ideas can really bring the literature we love and maybe new literature we haven't encountered, bring it to life and enhance our enjoyment of it. And, you know, this podcast, which is about, we like looking into things deeply, right?
Yeah.
We like following those ideas and going down rabbit holes. So yeah, this is that. This is what I love doing. Really.
And your work, I mean, I always say this too, that I love anything, any kind of work, whether it's fiction, nonfiction, that is going to spark me and I start Googling things on my own, because I love to put just as much back into what I'm reading as what I'm getting out. And I feel like there's so much in this work. Even if you come to this book with no real mathematical knowledge to start, it doesn't expect that you have, you know,
Absolutely.
A PhD in anything to start. Yeah. You can just pick this up and really find enjoyment no matter where you're at in a knowledge journey.
Absolutely. So my feeling is we as human beings, we enjoy patterns. Our brains, it like patterns and we like to see them. We like symmetry and we like structures, those kind of things we take a pleasure in. And that's why we enjoy, you know, the rhythms of music or beautifully symmetric pieces of art or poetry, which has rhythms and patterns and rhymes and all of these things. But those things, for me, that's what mathematics is about. So there's language of mathematics and we can use symbols and we can write algebra. But really underneath all of that, it's about patterns. And so, yeah, we can all enjoy these things. And you don't have to have any mathematical knowledge to access this book, because I want to show you, you know, actually, if you like patterns, you will love seeing them in your favorite stories and literature.
There's many things I will look at differently now as I go back. I mean, you start with and come back to several times this, your interaction with Moby Dick and sort of how this started a lot of things for you. And I think that's a book that many of us had read, sometimes begrudgingly and sometimes with enthusiasm. But I had never really thought of it in terms of math. And then as you were going through and laying out all the different things, I was like, of course, how did this not click? But I think it's just not something we're trained to look for when we read.
Yeah, I think that's right. So Moby Dick was, in a way, the real way, the start of this whole adventure for me, because I'd sort of through my life been observing, seeing things in books and poems. But as an adult, I read Moby Dick. So this isn't in British schools, you don't tend to be compelled to read it. It's a great American novel, but we have to read Dickens. So in Britain, Dickens, another genius, of course. So I came to Moby Dick, I thought, I must read this book. Everyone says it's, you know, a classic. And of course I had rebelled against that feeling. Oh, I don't want to do my homework, you know, but I'm so glad I did eventually. Everyone should read it. It's wonderful. And I started to read, and literally within about three pages, he had used a really brilliant little mathematical metaphor. He was talking about the inn where he was staying, the Spouter Inn, and the landlord tries to cheat you by making the glasses kind of get thinner at the bottom so that you think you're getting more hard liquor than you actually are. And he talks about parallel meridians being carved into the glass, right? And it's just a lovely little, very apt metaphor for that situation. And I thought, oh, that's interesting. That's quite, you know, I like that. And then every few pages, there'd just be another lovely little mathematical reference. So he talks about, for instance, he has a metaphor for loyalty. And this is Captain Ahab, who's talking to the cabin boy, and he says, loyal art thou as the circumference to the center, right? So we think of a circle, and yeah, the circumference of a circle is always exactly the same, loyally, steadfastly remaining the same distance from the center of the circle. And again, it's just a nice bit of metaphor, bit of mathematical imagery. And for me, what's really interesting about that is he's choosing, you know, Herman Melville is choosing from the furniture of his mind, what am I going to do here? No one's saying to him, right, you need 60 mathematical references in this novel. You know, he's going into his mind and picking out something that feels right to use. And there's a lot that's mathematical. And I got really interested in, actually, you know, what's Herman Melville's background? Why is he clearly enjoys these mathematical ideas? Because he's just putting them, they're everywhere, just all over the place in Moby Dick and his other writing. And I got really interested in why he's doing that. And I found that he actually loved mathematics. He won a prize for it in school. The prize was a book of poetry, which I absolutely, yes, this is exactly what a mathematician would like to receive. And yeah, it's just really fun reading about his references. And they add to your enjoyment of the book. You know, if you notice them and you understand a little bit about them, then that just, it's already a wonderful book and it's going to help you enjoy it even more.
So often I think there is this perceived huge divide between like the worlds of science and math and the world of the humanities and between math and literature. And yet so often when we look back at especially a lot of classic, what we call now the classic canon of authors, we see how often math was a part of their lives, from Melville to George Eliot and to all these other people, that they were really passionate about this as well. And it makes all these appearances, which sort of, you know, goes against this idea that, oh, they're such separate subjects and never the twain shall meet, or, you know, whatever the saying is.
Absolutely. I think, yeah, historically, you find that people are quite often doing both things. So Geoffrey Chaucer, right? Famous, probably the author of probably the first kind of English fiction book, I guess you could say. So he wrote the Canterbury Tales, but he also wrote a mathematical treatise on a mathematical instrument called the astrolabe. And he's doing both of those things. And then you've got, I mean, Wordsworth, much more recently, of course, poet, but he's really interested in science. And he writes about his love of geometry in his poetry. And then you have people who are like in India many centuries ago, traditionally mathematics was written in the form of verse. So people, you know, if you're going to be a mathematician, you have to be a poet because that's how we write our mathematics. And there are examples of poets, mathematicians, astronomers, all three of those things in one person. Omar Khayyam is an example. There's a poetry collection now called the Rubaiyat, which is probably the work of several authors, but he wrote a lot of those poems. But he also did some really interesting mathematics about solving certain types of equations that is kind of preceded work that happened in the West by several centuries, and he was doing both. So, you know, we get these links where people are interested in all sorts of different things historically. They're writing poems, they're doing mathematics, they're doing astronomy, and there's no one saying, you're in that box now, you're in the mathematics box, so you're not doing that stuff. It's all part of being, you know, having a general education, and people feel that they can do and enjoy all of those things. And, you know, you get people who have, as a hobby, they do a bit of geometry in their spare time. Abraham Lincoln enjoyed doing geometry in his spare time, for example. George Eliot, who you mentioned, you know, she was fascinated by mathematics and she writes a lot about it. So yeah, it's really, historically, people would definitely be interested in lots of different things, and there was nothing felt to be odd about that.
I remember the first time I learned about proofs, about mathematical proofs, when I was probably in my early teens or something in school. And I remember being like, this is math with words. And everything changed, and I suddenly got, I mean, doing it as a hobby, but I started learning more and more things on my own. And I think, unfortunately, a lot of times when you're, like, we have younger students in school, often, unfortunately, I think younger women or people of color sort of get discouraged from really engaging in mathematics in a lot of ways, because so often what we think of when we think of these, you know, the great mathematicians are, like, a lot of older white guys.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think that happens. I mean, even thinking about your sort of career as the Gresham professor of geometry, that this thing that's been around since 1597, and you are, of course, the first woman to hold that role, that, like, we sort of get this idea that math might be just for some people, but really it's not. It's for all of us.
Absolutely. And it's interesting and curious to me that there is this perception, yes, that it's only for some people and that somehow you have to be a genius to engage with mathematics at all, which is not how we think about sports or music, right? Okay, if you want to win the Olympic gold medal, you have to be extremely good. But that doesn't stop us then going to the park and going for a run or playing sports. We know that we can enjoy those things. We can watch them. We can watch the elite people doing those things. We can do them ourselves. We don't have to say it's only for those special ones. And music, you know, we all sing songs from a very young age. We sing, we play, we bang drums. We don't insist that you can only do it if you're in the elite. Whereas in mathematics, somehow, there is this perception, if you're not top of the class, then just give up. And that so makes me feel really sad, because I really think there's so much to enjoy for whatever level you are at. You know, you don't have to only do this if you're going to be a college professor. there is mathematics that we can all really enjoy. And even if we don't know the details of it, we can see the wonderful effects that can be produced. And then if you want to go on and learn the details, of course you can. But, you know, we can all enjoy these things from whatever level we're at.
I think some of my biggest connections to mathematics have come through literature. When I was a kid, I was obsessed with this book called The Eight by Catherine Neville, and it's about chess. It's kind of like a Da Vinci Code style book.
Yeah.
And there's so much chess and math in it, and I got really obsessed with it. And then later in life, more recently, Benjamin Labatet's books, When We Cease to Understand the World and The Maniac, and really being like, oh, this is not only about math, but this is about mathematicians and their wild lives and some of the crazy things they've done. And it really was like, oh, these worlds do meet. And it's such a fun way through literature to get to understand it a little bit better.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think, so you mentioned at the beginning, you know, I talked about everything from Moby Dick to Jurassic Park. And that's really true that, you know, it doesn't have to be a highfalutin book that, you know, you might not necessarily want to sit and read on the beach. There, every kind of literature has mathematical ideas in it. So, you know, I do talk about the Da Vinci Code, and there are some things about it I find kind of it amusing, let's say. But that doesn't mean it's not a good read, and you can still pick out these things, you know. And there are, if you're looking at a detective novel, you can think about, yeah, the ways in which you can understand who might be guilty. There might be secret codes of cryptography. All of those have mathematical ideas. In Jurassic Park, there's this brilliant set of diagrams in the book that they begin the sections. There are seven sections, and they each begin with a kind of particular diagram that gets more and more complicated. And actually, I know I'm looking at that and I can see mathematically it's this kind of picture called a fractal. And so one of the things I do in my book is to describe what this thing is and how it's made. And that just, it's really fun to see that in the book. And then if you recognize it for what it is, it just adds even more to the fun.
I don't want to disparage any books, but I feel like I have to ask, do you ever get stressed out if you're reading something and the math just like is bad or doesn't work or is blatantly wrong?
I mean, the thing that, everyone can make mistakes, you know. What I don't like is a sort of lazy stereotype. So the things that tend to annoy me will be if you've got a mathematician character who is, I don't know, just that real cliche of being perhaps really selfish because they're over-involved in their work or they can't cope with life. You know, they're a genius, but they just can't interact with anybody. Because that's really not, I feel like I have a badge made that says mathematicians are people too, because, you know, there are all sorts of mathematicians in the world, and some people are, you know, one kind of extreme, and that's okay, and others are some like other things. So, you know, you get mathematicians, we have hobbies, we enjoy other things than mathematics, you know? So that's my big, if I see a mathematician who just can't make a cup of tea, but is a genius, that's sort of this again, you know? And, right. And it's kind of, it is, I think, a damaging thing because it can be off-putting then. If you aren't that particular kind of person, you may think, well, I cannot be a mathematician. Whereas actually, you know, anyone can be a mathematician. And that's what I would like people to realize.
Your work really inspires this sort of sense of curiosity for looking at things from a different perspective. I think, like you said, I mean, it's easy to sort of say, yes, this is what we expect math to be like. This is what we expect mathematicians or people who enjoy math to be like. But you offer so many examples that are like, no, this is actually the contrary. There's so much more. And I think being able to come to things with a new sense of curiosity, any reader I know is always looking for that new thing, that new way to be like, of course, another angle. And that's so fun to go through this book to see like some of the classics and say, I can read this a little different now.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And, you know, if you know some of the context, then it just gives you that different outlook. And actually, I would say I am not the first mathematician to think about links between mathematics and literature. So Galileo, famous mathematician, he gave some lectures to the Academy in Florence about the geometry of Dante's Inferno. Right? This is, and I love this. So this is, you know, several hundred years ago. He was giving these lectures. He wanted to get a job. He wanted to get the professorship at the University of Pisa. And so what am I going to talk to the Florentine Academy about as a mathematician who wants a job? And this was, he got the job, right? He thought this is a valid topic of discussion. Let's just play around with what Dante says in, you know, the Divine Comedy in Inferno. And from the poetry, Galileo says, right, here's, I'm going to tell you about the geometry and the shape and the size and how all this works and fits together. And that, for me, that's exactly the kind of thing. So Galileo is doing a deep dive into Dante. That, I feel, that gives us permission, right? You know, if we needed it. This is absolutely a valid and fun thing to do that's really, like, intellectually satisfying. Let's see where this leads us. And in mathematics and everywhere else, you know, that question, what if? It's behind fiction, but it's also behind mathematics. And just following and exploring an idea, taking an idea for a walk, is so powerful across both of those things, mathematics and literature. That's kind of almost the common thing. Saying what if and seeing what the consequences of that are, you know, it's so powerful.
One of the best things about reading, or about sort of any scholarly endeavor, whether it's, again, from something very high, you know, education level, something really committed to something, you know, Jurassic Park, a choose your own adventure. There are all these ways that we can connect and understand and get a better grasp of the world we live in. I think especially for a lot of adults that I know, for even myself, and while I'm talking to other people, is we think math is something we do in school, or we think reading is something we do in school. And then once we get into our lives and we, you know, move on, we don't need that anymore. That's no fun for me. I want to keep learning forever and keep finding new things forever.
Yeah. And if, yeah, exactly. That's what both of these can do. You know, open a book and you're in a different world. And it's so wonderful. And then if you get interested in, I wonder, how is this put together? Why is this book working so well? That's one thought I often have, which leads me to think about structure. So just give an example. The book by Amor Towles, A Gentleman in Moscow, which is an amazing book. And when you read this book, it describes a period of several years in the life of this wonderful character, Count Rostov, who gets put under house arrest at the Hotel Metropole in Moscow for some crime that we don't need to mention. But, you know, it's this wonderful story of the time that he spends there. And it's told, so it's, the whole thing is set at this hotel. So you might think, well, is this going to be a bit boring? But the way it becomes not boring, or part of the reason it's such a brilliant book, is because of the structure of the book. And that is that events are set not at regular intervals, but sort of regular. And if you spot the mathematical pattern, it is really fantastic. Because, so he enters the hotel on one day, on the summer solstice, and then you hear about that day, and then one day later, and then 2 days later, and then 4 days later, and then it doubles and doubles and doubles until you get to like a year later, and then you hear about how he's doing after 2 years, 4 years, 8 years. So it doubles, but then there's an inflection point in the middle, and then it starts to halve again. And as you get closer to the end, those time periods shrink and shrink again, because there's some exciting action that happens at the end, which I won't go into, but read the book because it's fantastic. But he has this sort of concertina effect, double, 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 and then halving, 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 halving. And that sort of little mathematical sequence that he uses perfectly mimics human memory and experience, right? We all know exactly, we remember yesterday, a couple of days ago, and then our memory sort of, you know, time passes so quickly. And then we remember very clearly like our childhood in that real granularity. And that, for me, that is a perfect example of an author who is consciously, he's used this mathematical structure of halving and doubling to do something brilliant, to help us to enjoy this book and have the pacing be exactly right. Linearity would not work in this story like this. So he's doing this doubling and halving. And so reading the book, you get an experience of that. But if you see the structure, that lovely halving and doubling that's happening, for me anyway, that just really adds to your love for this already fantastic experience, right? You're like, oh my goodness, I've worked out what's happening. You know, it's really exciting.
It gives just that extra thing where, sure, you can read the book without knowing that and have just as good of a time, just as enriching of an experience. But every time you peel back a layer, you're like, oh, that's how The Luminaries feels, the Eleanor Catton. Just, yes. There are so many layers and you can read it from so many angles, and just finding all those connections. Yeah. By the end, you're like, I could start reading it again from the beginning right now and look for something else.
Yeah, exactly. You could read it. You could just read that book constantly every year. Yeah. And, you know, this, there are many books like that. I mean, there are people who, you know, will read Ulysses by James Joyce. They read it and then they read it again. And that, again, is something
I've done it once and that's enough.
Yeah, that's fine. Yeah. There are people who, you know, on Bloomsday every year will try and do the whole thing in a day. That, you know, everyone has their right amount of engagement with different books. So for me, I've read it for sleep. I don't know if I'm ever really going to read Finnegan's Wake. That's like, that's sort of next level.
It's a commitment of the mind, body, and soul, I think, to do that.
I think so, yeah. Yeah.
One of my favorite parts of this book, I touched on it just ever so briefly, but when you started talking about choose your own adventure books, I was like, first of all, that's my childhood.
Yeah.
Second of all, I absolutely cheated reading them. And I'm glad to know that that's okay and allowed.
It's looking around the corner. It's just, yeah. So you've got permission now from the author of one of those, a series of those books to say, yeah, it's just being careful.
I love that you spoke with him about the books because I think they're such a like niche, exciting thing that it's almost like talking to a celebrity that, you know, that really only you find a celebrity because you're like, this is great. But what a fun time to get to talk about those books.
I was so excited. So this is so Ian Livingstone, we're talking about, who has authored many of these books. And yeah, it was just amazing to talk to him. And I was a bit kind of, oh, it's a very nice man. But and he explained how my real question about these books is, so for those not familiar, you get like a little paragraph or something, and then it will say, you know, do you want to go west to the goblin castle, or do you want to go east to cross the dangerous river full of zombies or whatever it is? You make your decision and then the story bifurcates and off you go. And the challenge mathematically for this potentially is every time then that you make a decision, you're sort of doubling the universe of what you have to then continue in the narrative. And doublings make things big quickly, right? Mm-hmm. 10 choices potentially then leads you to 1,000 outcomes, 2 times 2 times 2, 10 times. And if you make 20 choices, it's not 2,000, you know, it's millions, right? So the number of choices you make during that book, in a typical book, you might be making 200 or 300 choices. So how is the book not the size of the known universe? Right. How are you fitting that under your bed covers to finish reading it at night when you should be asleep? So, and he explained, and we talked through about this, the design is really clever because some of those choices have to kind of collapse on themselves. And you have to have these, if you imagine like drawing a graph of this, like a network, things have to meet up again, but the reader cannot feel that their choices have no value or meaning. Otherwise it's boring. So you have to feel that your choices are genuine, and they are, but they also have to be controlled. So there's this tension between constraint and freedom, which is fascinating, and which, you know, the skill required in producing these stories, actually there's a lot of mathematics going on under the surface of controlling that. Otherwise you'd get this explosion, and how you control that is just, you know, a real skill.
I absolutely was also the kid where I was like determined to see behind the curtain, and I would just read it in order to be I'm just going to see. I mean, maybe read it for fun first, but I was like, I have to know. And I think even then, like as a kid, I was like, I still don't really know how this works, but now I do. So now I'm fine.
Yeah. It's all good. Now you can write one of your own.
Oh, well, maybe not that. I'm not that math savvy yet, but I'll get there. I would love to hear a little bit more about your research process to like compiling everything in this book, because you really have a lot of sources. You have a lot of texts that you work with. So I wonder, how did that process go of writing everything? How long did it take? All those good details.
Yeah. So the how long did it take is kind of, it took a year, but it also took 40 years because, you know, little things would come into my mind like, oh, that reminds me of this, that reminds me of that. That was one of the joys, was to be able to actually say, I have a legitimate reason now for following all these trails that I've wondered about over the years. I wonder if that person did anything else, or I wonder where this idea came from in that person's work. So I suppose initially the structure of the book being in these three parts of, where does mathematics show? It's in structure, it's in the symbolism and imagery, and it's in the actually maybe mathematical themes or mathematician writers. So I got my division into three sorted. And within that, then I would was really trying to think of, okay, how can I best show these ideas? So I would have, I would follow on trails. So I would, starting from an author or a few authors or themes, I would then, I would look, first of all, I was looking in the academic literature, have people written about, you know, where are the thesis on the mathematics in the work of Nathaniel Hawthorne? Not very much. That's why he's not in the book. But loads of Herman Melville. It's very interesting. Loads of Herman Melville and loads of, you know, particular writers you would see, lots and lots of, maybe they talk about science. And then I thought, well, if they're going to talk about science, maybe they'll talk about mathematics. And then I think about my own recollections and I'd be talking to other people and just following, it's rabbit holes all the way, right? As a phrase coined by Lewis Carroll, of course, who was a mathematician. And the process would be, I would coalesce a gigantic, this big pile of huge number of potential references and then whittle and whittle down. And it was, this is my first book. And so my first experience with an editor, and it was wonderful because she was amazing at really helping me to say, you know, I've got 45 examples of this thing. And she was really good at kind of helping me to narrow down that, you know, I would say, okay, I think these eight are just cannot live without eight. And she'd say, well, maybe this one could, you know, so we'd have this process. She'd say, maybe this thing could be a footnote, and it would be a footnote. And then after a few months, when I was less, you know, emotionally attached, she'd say, maybe we don't need that footnote. So yeah, about 10 times as much material as could fit in a book poured out. And then it was the refining process. And, you know, there's so much more one could have written. And then, yeah, this is an inexhaustible source of wonderful, exciting, literary things that have mathematics in them because they're just fundamentally linked. But yeah, I really enjoyed. So the chapter on, I thought, I've got to do something about numbers, you know, symbolism in numbers. And that was really fun to explore because that was one where I had ideas in my own head. But then I actively went looking to see, you know, I knew that the stories that I had grown up with is not necessarily, well, it definitely is not all of folklore. So I really enjoyed exploring fairy tales and folklore and mythology from cultures that, you know, I wasn't as familiar with, to look at how they use numbers in symbolism in other traditions. And that was absolutely fascinating to explore and learn about those ideas.
Did you have anything that like truly surprised you that you learned while you were going through, whether like more general or just like a fact that you're like, I can't have imagined this?
I mean, there were many things that even I was surprised at how much there was out there to be found. So that was a complete delight. Also, there's one example I'm thinking of where at the beginning when I was drafting the book and I was thinking of, you know, chapter headings and things, what make nice chapter headings, the geometry of narrative was a chapter heading, for example, and that came from a short story that I'd read. But there was one chapter and it was about kind of how mathematics can appear more overtly on the surface in literature. And I thought I was going to call this, because there's a book called Life of Pi, and I thought, well, I'll call this The Real Life of Pi. And before I'd read Life of Pi many years previously, but just, you know, that I thought that's a good title for the chapter. But then I thought, okay, of course, I'm going to reread Life of Pi now and just see if there's any mention. And I was so delighted because there's so much mathematics in it, which like I had perhaps sort of noticed a little bit when I was reading it just myself many years previously, but rereading it thinking I'm writing a book about mathematics and literature, there's so much, and I got really excited about it. And then it became this, you know, quite a big section in the book talking about the mathematical references in Life of Pi, of which there are many.
There's so much where even going back to something like Life of Pi, which of course I think many people have read or, you know, seen the movie, and you realize like, oh, it's, I don't want to be a conspiracy theorist who starts saying like math is everywhere at all times, but like math is everywhere at all times. So now I'm like, I want to just like give this book to people to be like, see, I'm not just saying weird stuff all the time.
No, exactly. I mean, and there's so much there. We could just say one thing that pi, the number, the mathematical number, which relates the diameter to the circumference of a circle. So it's a number, it goes on forever. You can't write it as a fraction or a decimal that finishes. So it carries on forever. And a number that you can't write as a fraction in mathematics is called an irrational number. It can't be written as a ratio of two whole numbers. So in mathematics, you've got this idea of irrational numbers. But then the boy, Pai Patel, who is telling this story of being, you know, shipwrecked and marooned at sea for all this time with a Bengal tiger named Richard Parker. And, you know, you're never quite sure whether what he's saying is true and whether it's sort of, is it a dream and how much is real and how much isn't. So then there's this lovely play on words in the whole book of, is Pi the boy irrational? Like Pi the number is irrational. So it just, that's just one charming thing about this book. And there are so many other little subtle ideas and references that just are really clear and lovely if you just know a tiny weeny bit of mathematics. And that's what I want to try and show people. So it's not like I'm saying you have to understand, you know, abstract algebra to see all this stuff. It's really there, just waiting to be seen and enjoyed.
Not to just keep asking for math facts, but I am just going to keep asking for math facts because that's why I'm here. Is there anything that you really wished you could have fit in the book, but it just didn't work?
So I think, I mean, there were more things I would like to have said. So some of the poetry, the structures in poetry, you know, you could write a whole book about mathematics and poetry, right? So maybe that's a project for another time. But I had a chapter, you know, really about poetry. And so there was some really cool poetry that involves the Fibonacci numbers that I was in an early draft. And then we're like, oh, this chapter's already too big. So that came in. So we do talk about the Fibonacci numbers and the Fibonacci sequence at various points in the book. But yeah, so kind of interesting ways in which those can be used in poetry. I didn't quite make it in there. And some other ideas. So I wanted to talk a bit more about Dante, but I didn't. I didn't. Again, so much mathematics. And then more mathematical, like mathematicians who get cameo roles or even starring roles in literature. And that's, I'm very fascinated by that and, you know, how those ideas are treated. So, but I keep finding more things, you know, so yeah, people will keep writing books. People have written books since mine came out that like, oh, I wish the passengers had come out, you know, before right. Passenger yeah. had come out before the book, but yeah, I couldn't include it because it wasn't published yet. But yeah, so the, there will always be more things and I would have liked to spend more time on Lewis Carroll. We did a bit on him. There's always more to say. So much more one could have said. So yeah, yeah.
You'll just have to write a sequel, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. Twice upon a point.
Twice. Yes. Switching gears just the tiniest bit, I'd like to talk about sort of your life as a reader and your literary influences and sort of what you gravitate towards in fiction, either things that sort of shaped you or things that you've been reading recently.
Yeah. So, I mean, I'm a voracious reader. So in a sense, everything. And I was very lucky that when I was a kid, my parents loved books and there were just, you know, floor to ceiling books everywhere. They know, you know, that was the main, probably it felt like the main source of expenditure in the house was new books. So for me as a little kid, I would just sort of wander around and I'd pick a book off the shelf and I'd start reading it. And maybe I wouldn't understand a word and maybe I would, and maybe I'd understand some, but that experience of, it's okay that I'm not understanding everything, that I would recommend to anybody, just so picking up things randomly. So as a kid, I mean, I read lots of kids' books, but I was sort of intermixed with the books that I randomly pulled off the bookshelf, which, you know, were a complete mix of all sorts of things. I read all the, like, Lord of the Rings and things like that when I was a little kid, and I used to like drawing maps of the countries and thinking about what life would be like. And as I got older, I got really into Jane Austen for a bit, and then I got into Dickens, and then I started reading, I read a bit of science fiction, and then I started reading, you know, I had said, right, I'm going to read all the classics. So I tried to read those. Yeah, like, oh, I don't know. I love everything. I love everything is my basic, what sort of books do you like? All the books. But yeah, now what am I reading right now? Oh, well, I've just read Tomorrow and Tomorrow and Tomorrow, which is wonderful. And I always read the Booker Prize shortlist every year. So that happened end of last year. All the Pauls, there were three people called Paul on the shortlist.
Yes.
I loved all of their books. Loved all of their books. I think maybe, yeah, with the Bee Sting was, might have been, Prophet's Song was amazing. I mean, yeah, you know, all amazing. Yes. I've just read In Memoriam by Alice Wynne, which is just Amazing. Yes. So, you know, you might think it's about the First World War, and it's about, you know, these two young men who go off to the front, and one of them's a poet. And you might think, oh, I've read that. You know, I know about that, or I've read plenty of novels about that. But this one is so beautifully written, and it really does. I really felt that I was having a new experience reading that. Even though many of us, we've probably read lots of books about the First World War, and you've read all the First World War poets, but this was genuinely really amazing book and put together so beautifully. So yeah, that's what I just finished reading.
I love that. And we can always think about, I mean, of course, now any book I read, I'm going to be like, is there any math in here as I go through? And there always will be.
But, well, I've got Burnham Wood as my reading pile as the next one. So Eleanor Catton, who wrote The Luminous. So I have got high hopes that there'll be something in there for me.
It's a great book. To end things off, for our listeners who are maybe have gotten to the end and are like, this was a lot of math and I'm unsure about it, do you have a recommendation of, like, if people want to start out learning more after they read Once Upon a Prime to really get a better idea of math in any sense? Do you have, like, any good recommendations for starters?
Yeah, so at the end of the book, there's actually a little section called A Mathematician's Bookcase, which has loads and loads of, I mean, lots of literature in that people might like to start exploring. But there's a couple of mathematics type themed books. And I would say, if you want to get a bit more into the mathematical ideas, but you're still into the literature part, you could do a lot worse than reading Martin Gardner's book, The Annotated Alice. So this is Alice in Wonderland, Alice Through the Looking Glass, but with Martin Gardner, who is a great writer on mathematics and recreational mathematics. He has added lots of commentary, and he goes a little bit more into the mathematical ideas. And that itself as well has lots of places that can send you, you know, for finding out more. So I would say that's, like, would be maybe the next kind of step in terms of a bit more mathematical, but it's still full of literature.
So now you have that, everyone. But first, you need to pick up Once Upon a Prime, because it is an incredible time. It's a great journey through so many things that will be familiar and new. And it's going to be out in paperback now. So, Sarah Hart, thank you so much for talking with us today.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. Poured Over is a Barnes & Noble production. To help other readers find us, please rate and review the show wherever you listen to podcasts.